Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 61. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, friend and colleague John DeGraff, producer of the classic Affluenza video and co-author of the Affluenza book. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye after my cue, after the interview. John DeGraff works as an independent film producer at public television in Seattle. He produced The Affluenza, The All-Consuming Epidemic, and Escape from Affluenza films, and co-authored the Affluenza book. The third edition of the book was released in 2014, the Kindle in 2015. He's a founding member of the Simplicity Forum and serves as national coordinator of the forum's Take Back Your Time Day initiative since 2003. As an independent producer of television documentaries, he is the recipient of more than 100 regional, national, and international awards in filmmaking. The DeGraff Environmental Filmmaking Award, named in his honor, is presented annually at the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival in Nevada City, California. John DeGraff is a co-founder and senior partner of the Happiness Initiative. He urges you to take the Happiness Counts survey based on the Domestic Happiness Index. He is a frequent speaker on issues of overwork and overconsumption in America. He produced Silent Killer, the unfinished campaign against hunger. In 2005, John was the World Food Day George McGovern Lecturer at the Food and Agricultural Organization in Rome. Read a review of Dave Baker's and John's recent book, What's the Economy For, Anyway? Why It's Time to Stop Chasing Growth and Start Pursuing Happiness. From that has come the New Economy Coalition. Be sure to listen to my two-part conversation with John from fall of 2013 on the Common Good podcast. John is truly a champion of simple living. Read more at the link in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. John DeGraff has been involved with Affluenza for the last 20 years, and that included the production of the Affluenza documentary and then the Affluenza book. Affluenza, of course, is a combination of the words influenza and affluence to indicate that too much stuff can be a disease, a sickness. So, John, if you would, tell us about your experience with affluenza and anything that's been developing more recently in that regard.
Sure, Jerry. Happy to do so. The film Affluenza was made, as you mentioned, we began it 20 years ago exactly, and it came out in 1997. And that was really at a time when it couldn't have been more, I think, relevant, because the United States was in a big boom. An economic boom in which salaries for everybody were rising, and there was a sense that there was no tomorrow and we could just shop till we drop, and there really wouldn't be any consequences of that. As we all know, that didn't last very long, and by the time the Affluenza book came out in 2001, that was starting to change already, and while Americans were still buying a lot of stuff, we were starting to realize the cost in terms of debt and overwork and other things that were coming from that. And so I was actually criticized by now Senator Elizabeth Warren for not focusing enough on the issues of poverty and other things that were hitting large numbers of Americans at the same time as some of us were getting much richer, faster, and spending like there was no tomorrow. Since that time, the book has had three editions. The last one came out in 2014. It's been published in 12 different countries in 10 different languages. And I think the word affluenza has now become something a part of our vocabulary in many ways for negative reasons, but well, it is a negative word after all. But the most recent case being the situation in Texas, where a young man who got drunk, drove a truck illegally, and killed four people was able to escape prison on an affluenza defense in which it was claimed that he was a poor little rich kid who never learned right from wrong. That same kid was put into a probation and a treatment program, which he has left, and he's now on the lam, and people are searching for him. And this has been probably the biggest use of the term affluenza since the word came out. I didn't coin the term, but I think I popularized it. And I've been asked about that, and I say that it's a terrible thing, obviously, that this kid got off because of the money. His parents had funded the judge's campaign, and it was pretty shoddy stuff. But on the other hand, before we finger point too much in this country, we need to think that a lot of people die around the world and at home because of our relentless pursuit of stuff. And, you know, we're willing to take away food stamps from people who that don't have enough to eat just to make sure that we can keep the stuff coming in.
Now, John, there's also recently some psychological studies that have been done indicating that affluenza is a sickness of the wealthy, and it makes them less generous, that all this wealth actually changes their brains. And the solution that was in this article, anyway, I read, was philanthropy, to urge the affluent to be more philanthropic, and that will reverse some of the damage caused by affluenza. What is your take on that?
Well, I think that's probably true. I mean, there's no doubt that there's a huge mind-body connection, and that things that we do that are psychological do actually in some ways impact the brain. It's hard to tell exactly how much, but I think we do know that those kind of things have an impact. One thing we know for sure is that if your prime pursuit and your motivation is materialistic, that is, if you're out for the money, you're likely to be less happy, more disturbed, more depressed, and such through life than if your goal is service, your goal is to make life better for everybody. So the students who go to college with the goal that I'm going to get the good job and make a lot of money, consistently studies by people like Tim Kasser and others, psychologists, have shown that this is precisely the opposite thing, and that those people end up being less happy, that when your motivation is money, you can never have enough of it. When your motivation is service, love, caring for others, you get rewards beyond what you expect.
Now, as a follow-up to affluenza, if I'm correct, John, you wrote a book, co-authored the book, Whose Economy Is It Anyway? Tell us about that.
Oh, what's the economy for anyway was actually the title. But yes, that book came out in 2011 and then the paperback version in 2012. And it really just asked that simple question, I think we ought to be talking about. You know, we measure the success of our economy in how much stuff we produce. We call it the gross domestic product. The grosser it gets, the better we think we're doing. But the question is, does that really make us happier? Does that improve our lives, our community, our connection with each other, our health, all of these good quality of life things? And we actually find that there isn't that obvious a connection. Yes, countries that have higher GDPs are generally a little better off than countries that have low GDPs, no question about it. But beyond a certain point, we need to ask a different question. What do we want the economy to do? And if we want it to be about happy people, strong communities, good health, sharing and giving and caring about each other, then we need to make the economy orient itself toward those things, and we need to measure those things as we build the economy of the future and construct the economy of the future. That was the message of the book, and I sort of start with Maslow's hierarchy of needs and say, well, you know, we've done a pretty good job in this society with the basics, with the bottom stuff. We still have people in poverty, but most people have plenty of the physiological needs met in this society. But where it starts getting weak is when we start looking at belongingness and connection and people's sense of self-worth and all of those things. Surprisingly, we're doing a very poor job in this direction despite all the wealth we have.
Well, I remember, John, well, our meeting in Colorado about 15 years ago when you announced the Take Back Your Time Day initiative. That was a part of the Simplicity Forum meeting.
Right.
And so tell us about how that's developed and how you're involved with that now.
Yes, it actually started in 2002, so you're right, almost 15 years ago. A group of us were then gathered. This was before the Colorado meeting. We were gathered at a meeting in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and that meeting included people like Juliet Shore, who wrote The Overworked American, and Kim Kasser, who I mentioned did the studies on materialism, and Vicki Robbins, Cecile Andrews, Frances Moore LePay, a lot of kind of the activists in the alternative economy movement. And we got to talking about how we could do something to put the idea of simplicity, of simplifying lives and deconsuming to an extent, on the agenda. And it became clear to us that we didn't want to do that as just a guilt trip. Oh, you're consuming too much, it's going to wreck the planet and all that. That may be true, but it's not very effective in reaching people. There has to be some kind of different message, more positive message. So what we decided instead is that we needed to say, no, you know, the sacrifice is now. You are sacrificing something very important to your lives in order to go on this spending binge and to keep this constant economic growth coming. And the thing you're sacrificing is time, that in order to pay for all of this, Americans were working the longest hours in the industrial world, some 9 weeks longer than Europeans, for example. And it was really costing us in terms of our health and our connection and other things. So we came up with this idea that we wanted to focus some of the attention of the voluntary simplicity movement around the idea of the option being more time rather than more stuff. The Center for New American Dreams called it more of what matters. But it was the same theme, that we needed time in our lives to take care of each other and our health and so forth. So we got the idea. I'm not sure, I don't remember exactly who came up with the idea, but the idea was that we should have a day to bring this on the agenda, that to call a day, Take Back Your Time Day, would be a way to draw media attention to this issue. And we celebrated that first Take Back Your Time Day on October 24th, 2003. And we picked that date, October 24th, because it was 9 weeks before the end of the year and sort of represented that 9 weeks more than Americans were working compared to Europeans and the impact of that. What we didn't know when we selected that date was that October 24th also turned out to be the day, purely serendipitously, that the 40-hour work week became the law of the land in 1938 in the United States. Well, actually, the law was signed then, and it became the law in 1940. So it was a very interesting coincidence, and it led us to keep that date, October 24th, as Take Back Your Time Day, rather than shifting around based on how much more we worked or less compared to Europeans. And so for 12 years now, we've been celebrating in more or less Take Back Your Time Day. The first years were very successful, as many as 200 communities and colleges held events, now less so, but we're coming back. I think the thing is we took a big hit with the recession in 2008. People were a lot more concerned then with will I have a job at all and whether I work too much and so forth. But now as the economy has come back in the traditional sense of there being more money and more jobs, I think people are waking up to this issue of overwork once again, maybe to a degree we haven't seen before. And so our organization is coming back to life, and we had more celebrations this year of Take Back Your Time Day than we have probably since 2008.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we've been talking a lot about happiness during this little talk, and so let's talk about another big project of yours, the Global Happiness Initiative.
Right. Yeah. And I'm a little less involved with that, although I am still a huge believer in it. I still am involved, but I've focused more recently again on the Take Back Your Time movement as part of that, because one of the key things we know from science is that time balance is a key factor in whether people are satisfied with their lives, whether they're happy or not. But I got introduced in 2009 a little bit before that, but primarily in 2009 when I was invited to an international happiness conference in Brazil, to this concept of gross national happiness, and to this little country called Bhutan in Asia, where the economy was actually focused on gross national happiness rather than gross national product. And this fascinated me. I was invited to speak at the conference about the subject of time balance because of my expertise there and because the Bhutanese and the others considered time balance so important for happiness. So I found out there that people around the world were really looking for alternative measures to this GDP thing, and that they were doing a lot of things. And I found that the city of Victoria, British Columbia, only 80 miles away from where I live in Seattle, was actually surveying its citizens with an excellent survey about how happy they were and how their quality of life was in many areas, including time balance and other factors, family life and community and health and so forth. Got very excited about that, brought that back to Seattle. We used the survey from D.C. for a year in Seattle, and then we worked with some psychology folks at San Francisco State University to create a shorter survey because we weren't getting enough response to the longer one. So we now have at happycounts.org, that's the website for the Happiness Initiative. There's a 15-minute survey that people can take. I think it's a lot of fun to take it. And when you finish, you get a score in all these areas of quality of life to see how you're doing. And you can see how that compares with the 55,000 other people, mostly in the U.S., but around the world, who have completed the survey. So that's stimulated quite a lot of interest. Laura Musikansky, my colleague in that work, runs that website today. She's doing a marvelous job. She and I had the opportunity in October to travel to Guadalajara, Mexico, for the annual international conference of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development on measuring happiness and well-being. OECD represents the richest, basically, 35 countries in the world. Those countries were, many of them are now trying to measure things other than simply GDP. And so it was a fascinating meeting. The report was absolutely stunning. As I went through the data, it became clear to me just how poorly the United States is doing in many measures of quality of life compared to other rich countries. But most significantly, how poorly we are doing when it comes to the quality of life for our children. It is a disaster. We rank basically only one from the bottom of all of those rich countries in the quality of life for children.
Wow, that is stunning, John. Well, tell us, if you would, if you have any other projects planned for the near or distant future, or about some other activities that might be remotely related to the voluntary simplicity movement in the last while.
Well, I think the movement is still there in a personal sense. I think what we have to do is find some ways to make it more possible for Americans to live more simple and modest lives, but still live decently. What we have seen in the past 35 years or so is essentially this immense increase in inequality. And so while the top 10, maybe 20% of the population have been doing quite well and who their incomes have been improving, and at the top 1%, as we know, they've been doing staggeringly well in a material sense, that hasn't been true for the bottom part of the population. Median incomes have actually fallen since 2000, so we have a situation of involuntary simplicity for a lot of people, and that makes things difficult in certain ways, especially as rents are skyrocketing in many places, the cost of health care is going up, and so the basics are becoming hard to meet. So I think we have to think, we could say to those who have a lot, be generous, and they should be, and cut back and live modestly. That's certainly the message for those who are doing well in our society. But somehow we have to find a way also to consider those who are not doing well, particularly the quarter of the population or now of children who are in poverty, the near 20% of the population in poverty, and find out how to at least make sure that those folks have the basics, that they're not dealing with homelessness, that they're not dealing with hunger, and so forth. I think we have to find a way to deal with this fundamental crisis of inequality in our country, and it's elsewhere, but it's more serious here, I believe, if we are to talk seriously about voluntary simplicity and a modest and comfortable standard of life. One thing that makes me very hopeful in all of this is the attitude, the ideas, the proclamations of the new Pope, not so new anymore, but Pope Francis, has really been a strong advocate of reducing inequality, of living modestly, a critic of consumerism, certainly a great voice in warning us about the dangers of global warming and all of those things. That's a remarkably positive thing, and I think we can all learn a lot from what the Pope and other religious leaders are saying along these lines. So that's one of the things that gives me hope. I also think the millennial generation, more and more, is starting to say, no, we actually want time in our lives made a little more than just the bucks. We want a different quality of life. We've seen our parents work themselves to death. We don't really want that for ourselves. And so there are hopeful signs as well as obviously very scary ones. And what we're doing to the climate is we really have to reduce overconsumption and slow down and simplify and cut our use of fossil fuels and the products that are made from them if we're to have hope for a future at all for our kids.
Well, what I'm hearing a lot, John, is that some folks feel that any inequality needs to be resolved by personal generosity. On the other hand, I hear some folks saying that we need some government intervention or government regulation or even a different changes in taxation in order to even things out a little bit, whether that be in health care or in basic human needs. How are you seeing this work its way out? I mean, we're being guilted, for example, to take care of the veterans when we have a bloated defense budget. It just rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you, Jerry. I mean, I'm 99% on the latter end. I think we need enormous policy shifts in this country in taxation and other kinds of things. We need to rebuild our safety net in this country. We need to bring back food stamps for the people who need them. We need a lot of changes in the policy arena. Now, that doesn't do the whole thing. One of the things we learned when I was in Bhutan as an advisor to the Bhutanese government and their happiness program and report they were doing for the United Nations in 2013. And one of the things we concluded then was that happiness and well-being aren't synonymous, that well-being is those aspects of quality of life that you can measure using objective criteria, like health is, you know, life expectancy and so forth, whereas happiness is those aspects of the quality of life that have to do with how people subjectively feel about their lives. So in that case, health would be, do you think your health is good, poor, and so forth. So we need to look at both of those things, and then we need to understand that policy change is absolutely necessary in order to improve well-being and to improve those basic minimum standards of life that people need to have a decent life. But that's not the end of it. Beyond that, we also need personal positive change toward what we call happiness skills, ideas like gratitude and tolerance and delayed gratification and altruism and all of those kinds of things. We need that kind of personal change to translate simple well-being and a good quality of life in the physical sense into true happiness. So both are needed, but in this country in particular, I think we cannot ignore the importance of policy change right now to get inequality under control.
Well, both you and I, John, are from the older generation of simple livers. I've found quite a bit of hope recently in new people that I've met who are younger, who are organizing events, organizing locally, blogging, podcasting, that kind of thing. Are you seeing and feeling the same thing?
Oh, yes, and at both levels, at the personal change level of people figuring ways to slow down, to live a little different, of the building of local economies, you know, and time dollars and all of these kind of things. At the same time, in the policy arena, I think that's happening at the local level as well. I live in Seattle, and we've seen here an enormous push for things like the $15 minimum wage, which we passed, and which will make life much better for people at the bottom end of the spectrum. We're also, you know, seeing things in other communities that are like that. And we're seeing some of these kinds of things happening internationally. One of the things that gives me hope is to look now at the experiments going on in Sweden, for example, with a six-hour workday. Many cities are now in Sweden and now trying to experiment with having people work 6 hours rather than eight, starting with government workers, certain firms and companies. And the preliminary results from that experiment have been enormously positive. People are more productive, they're healthier, happier, they feel better about their lives. The cost is a little bit higher to do that, but the rewards are so much greater. I think this is a movement that has legs.
Excellent. Well, do I hear another book or another documentary bubbling up here, John?
Well, I don't know yet. It's a lot of work to write a book. A little less to do a documentary, but you have to raise a lot more money to do a documentary. So either way, it's difficult, and I'm, going to be 70 this coming year, so I have to slow down a little bit myself. But I am working on an article right now about looking at the quality of life for children around the wealthy world and saying, just why is it that American kids are doing so badly in so many areas of life by contrast to European kids or Canadian kids or Australians, or and what's leading to this and what can we do about it? And the reason I've selected this is because it becomes very difficult with adults, because if adults aren't doing so well, you always have this strain of thought in our country that says, well, that's their fault. It's their personal responsibility. They should pull themselves up by the bootstraps. I didn't need anybody to help me. They don't need anybody to help them, and so forth. This is a common refrain from one part of our society. You can't say that about kids. You can't say that a five-year-old should pull themselves up by their bootstraps, or that if they're not getting nutrition or education or any of these kinds of things, that it's somehow their fault. And so I think that message about that it starts with childhood, and that we're doing very poorly when it comes to children. Europeans will ask a question often, why do Americans hate children? I've had that asked many times, because they know what these numbers show. And I know that Americans don't hate children. I know Americans love their kids just as much as anybody else does. But in terms of what we do and our willingness to sacrifice any of this affluenza in our society to make life better for those kids, particularly poor kids, we're not showing that love in a collective way and in a social way. And so I want to look at that. And it's interesting. The data is complex. So, for example, Americans' parents work longer than people in almost any other rich country. I knew that, so I thought, well, maybe one of the problems is that parents don't spend enough time with their kids. So I looked at the data on that, and actually it turns out that American parents spend more time with their kids than people in almost any other wealthy country. And I thought, wow, that's strange. How does that work? And I realized that what Americans do, American parents, for example, is we put everything into our kids, essentially. So we sacrifice our time with each other our time with friends, our time in the natural world, our time playing as adults and stuff, to do these things that we think will make our kids get ahead. And in doing so, we spend a lot of time chauffeuring these kids, so a lot of time is driving where the kids are in the car, not so much in other places. It's this endless series of scheduled events for kids, and everybody's stressed. The parents are stressed, and the stress goes down to the kids. You take the Netherlands, by contrast, where parents work the least in the rich world, they don't spend as much time with their kids as we do. Their kids are involved in only one-third as many extracurricular activities as American kids, but the Netherlands ranks on the top in virtually every quality of life category measured, and their kids are the happiest kids in the world by their own self identification. So it shows that we need to think about this thing that we have about just pushing kids and thinking we've got to drive them to do this, they got to be in all these things to get in the best colleges, to get ahead, to make the money. We're just going about it the wrong way completely, and I think that's the point I want to make.
Well, thank you for going after that, John, and we'll sure look forward to that article. On a little different note, they've had change of leadership at the Center for New American Dream. Wendy is leaving at the end of this year, and they've hired a new director. I've stayed in touch with them, you know, peripherally over the years. What's your sense? Are they still doing good work? Are they still prospering?
Yes. Oh, yes. I think that they're doing very good work, and I think Wendy did a wonderful job in her term as executive director. I don't know the new person, but I'm hoping that she will carry on what Wendy has been up to. I hear good things from Tim Kasser and others. Tim's on the board, and he and I talk quite a lot. So I feel positive about it. I think that what New Dream has done is kind of gone back to its focus, which was a better quality of life for everybody, and that includes things like the time issues and, less material Christmas and, you know, showering kids with caring and not stuff and those kind of simple living and quality of life messages rather than a pure focus, which I think the organization had. And I understand the reason, but I think that for a period of time in, 5-6 years ago, before Wendy came on board and the change, New Dream became just one more environmental organization focused on climate change. And it really lost its central direction about quality of life. And as one who believes that climate change is hugely important, I don't want to criticize that too much, except that the fact is that I think even when we deal with climate change, we have to offer people some kind of alternative way of life that uses less fossil fuel and all these things, but still gives people a good life. So I think that quality of life message is still essential as part of the battle against climate change. And I saw New Dream as the only organization that was really doing that, as focusing on the whole quality of life rather than any single issue or single aspect of that. And I felt they lost that for a period of time, and they became obsessed with telling people to get government agencies to buy Priuses and do all these things for climate change. And I'm really glad to see that they're back in what I consider the right direction, and I think they are starting to grow as a result of that.
Thank you so much for that word. Anything else you'd like to share?
I just want to wish everybody, you and everybody else, a really happy new year, Jerry. I guess one thing I would want to share is that it comes from a statement you made about the military budget versus the veterans. I hope that the words of peace on earth, goodwill to men, to people, that message really comes through, because I think before anything else, we really need that message. We really need to start turning guns into plowshares, as the saying, we need to really start analyzing where we spend our money and whether it's doing much for peace in the world or for quality of life for us or anything else. And I think if we understand that 1 week of the budget of the military spent each year could essentially eliminate hunger in the world, and that's not my figure, that's the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization figure, then we really have to realize that our priorities are off base, that if we were to do a serious job of ending poverty and hunger in the world and trying to give people some kind of decent life like the Pope is advocating, we could do a lot more than our constant military interventions and our spending on that. So I think that's the big issue for 2016 is let's deal with equality and let's work toward world peace.
You've been listening to my conversation with filmmaker and author John DeGraff. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or on our Facebook page or the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. Even though our best-known annual resource, Whose Birthday Is It Anyway?, is no longer produced on paper, we can still publish it online. See the link in the show notes. If you want to contribute an article or a piece of art for fall of 2016, while the season is still fresh in your mind, take a look at the simple guidelines. And you can produce your own customized, do-it-yourself, Who's Risen from the Dead Anyway? For Lent and Easter. You're welcome to assemble and copy a version that meets your local needs. See the show notes for tips to create, produce, distribute, and promote it. Time to wrap up this edition of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular and want to say goodbye here, peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3, click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want, with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the theme music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity. Choosing to live simpler lives is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of living more with less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed those standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping a people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.